Guys,
no, you back off! You back off! This is executive level business!
Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Sweet Smell of Succession, a weekly recap podcast about the HBO original series Succession. I'm David Chen, and joining me, as always, she is the editor-at-large at primetimer.com and the co-host of Extra Hot Great, Tara Ariana. How are you doing today?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm doing well and excited to dive into yet another episode of Succession with you. This week, we're going to be diving into Succession Season 2, Episode 4, Safe Room. You can always find more episodes of this podcast at successionpodcast.com and email us at successionpodcast@gmail.com. Now, before we dive into today's episode, Tara, there's a few things that we haven't picked up on in previous weeks, or rather we have picked up on but haven't had a chance to mention, that I wanted to make sure we just get out there before we dive into this week's episode. One of them is that last week on the podcast, Season 2, Episode 3, we discussed the biographer for the Roys, the unauthorized biographer for the Roys, Michelle Pansel, I think is her name in the show.
Mm-hmm.
And I did want to call out that there are a lot of parallels with that story and the real life story of Roger Ailes and his would-be biographer, Gabriel Sherman, right?
Mm-hmm.
That book that Gabriel Sherman wrote, The Loudest Voice, has since been made into a Showtime miniseries that you have watched a few episodes of, if I'm not mistaken, right?
I have not finished it yet. I'm in episode 5 of 7. I fell off it, but yes, I have been watching it.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think of the show?
Succession is better because it can have more fun. It can be because it's fictional, and a lot of the stuff in The Loudest Voice aims to be shocking, and because of where we are in our lives and as a society, some of it is sort of like, this is kind of what I expect things are like inside Fox News. And especially if you read the book, like, it's not as dramatic or melodramatic as I think it's trying to be. And I also question why it's airing now, because that means it won't be eligible even for Emmys until next year.
Right.
Which is crazy for all of the big name talent that's attached to it. So, you know, it's fine. I will finish it, but I would never, I would not call it a must see show.
You have not seen anything as shocking in The Loudest Voice as in, for instance, the last episode of Succession, in which boss, Rupert Murdoch-esque character Logan Roy, forces everyone to get on the ground and oink like pigs to prove their loyalty to him. That didn't happen in the book.
Like I said, I haven't finished it. So,
okay, well, we'll see.
No, nothing like that happens. Although there are panic rooms and bunkers in both. So that's another parallel between them.
Yeah. But yeah, it was very well known that Roger Ailes tried to get the book shut down.
Mm-hmm.
He tried to sue Gabriel Sherman, or he would send people to follow him around and do all kinds of insidious things to get him to stop writing the book. And so in the same way as Logan Roy in Succession is not too thrilled about having this biography written about him, Roger Ailes also wasn't excited in real life. But honestly, one of the things that I was impressed by about the American publishing system is that line that Jerry says is something along the lines of, "We do not yet live in a country where I can stop the publication of a book." And that is true in real life as well, because despite Roger Ailes' hundreds of millions of dollars of resources, he was unable to stop the book from being published. And mm-hmm. I do think that there is, you know, still hope for a free press yet if people can still take aim at some of our biggest plutocrats. So anyway, wanted to call out that there is a parallel with The Loudest Voice in real life with this biography plotline, which comes into play again in this episode, Season 2, Episode 4.
A
couple of other things to follow up on. One of them is that this year on Succession, there are different opening credits to the show. I've been so enthralled with Tara's recaps. I have not mentioned it on the podcast, but it is something that did catch my eye when I saw Season 2, Episode 1. The opening credits originally in Season 1 seemed to position Kendall and Roman as like the two guys that would be like the possible successors to Logan Roy. That's like kind of my sense. There's many shots with just the two of them with Logan Roy. You know, presumably these are like home movies from the Roy's childhood. And this season there is a different set of opening credits that gives much more emphasis to the other two children, specifically Shiv and Connor. That's my perception. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I would say the differences are very subtle, but they're more effective for that. Yes.
Because I think once they knew that Shiv would be a huge part of this season, they had to kind of scramble a little bit to go back to these opening credits, because it's like, hey, it would be very jarring for Shiv to be positioned to take over everything if she's not even really a factor in these opening credits. You know, she's very, kind of to the side in the opening credits. And so I thought it was interesting how they had to go back, presumably try to recreate, like, all those sets, all those actors are probably gone, you know, like, they had to try to get them back or redo something in order to make it match the themes of and the plot lines of this season. And so I think it is interesting to compare those two sets of opening credits.
Or they just shot a whole bunch on whatever day or days they had these actors, because they didn't know how they would need to use it in the future. So they're just remixing it. It's like the Friends in the Fountain. They had to keep using different shots from that shoot.
Yeah. I mean, they really dined out on that fountain shoot for many, many years. Who knows how they did it in this case? Maybe they were okay. But to my eye, it looked like a little bit different in terms of style than the new scenes looked a little bit different. It didn't feel like it all came from one shoot, but I don't know. Maybe one day we'll have a chance to ask Jesse Armstrong about it. But in any case, the opening credits are different in a way that is suitable to what's happening in this season. And there's also some interesting little Easter eggs, right? Like a shot of ATN you see on.
That we see a blonde news anchor on ATN giving a report, which obviously we don't hear, but the Chiron says something about gender fluid illegals. Just very like, oh, that's where we are. Got it.
Yeah. I kind of really enjoy all the Fox News parallels, and we're going to get to more of them in this episode of the podcast. Gender fluid illegals. Definitely one of the biggest scourges haunting America, according to ATN. Okay, a couple of other things before we get to this episode of the show and of the podcast. One of them is that, as you might have heard last week, we are starting to shout out people who contributed to the Kickstarter. Thank you so much for everyone who made this podcast possible. If you want us to shout you out and you did donate at that level, please fill out the survey that I sent out. Go to kickstarter.com, log in. I sent a survey. Please respond so we can make sure you get shouted out as appropriate. And if you didn't register for that reward, just thank you in general. You are awesome. And you will not get a shout out by name, but you are getting a shout out, not by name, in our hearts. So know that. And finally, there are many podcasts and shows and after shows about Succession, and many of them are great. One of them is by my colleague, Joanna Robinson. If you are enjoying this one, we would greatly appreciate it if you'd leave a review for us or a star rating at Apple Podcasts. It really does help us to differentiate ourselves from the other shows when we have some nice reviews and star ratings on there. So if you are enjoying this, please do leave us a review at Apple Podcasts. It would help a lot. Okay, so that's all the house cleaning and also follow-ups from previous week's episodes. Let's dive into Season 2, Episode 4, Safe Room. Tara, take it away. What happened to this episode?
Okay, well, this is a hard one to break down. And the first episode of Season 2 and maybe of the whole series to take place, apart from a brief coda, pretty much all on one day. So Shiv has, as promised, come into Waystar, and both she and Logan are so vague about what she's doing that they're just making everyone more suspicious than they probably would be otherwise. One of the first things Shiv notices is that Kendall is now in charge of Logan's meds, something that may end up being important later. It's the only reason I mention it here. She also finds out from a surprisingly loose-lipped Jerry that people at Waystar know about Kendall's shoplifting, which we saw him do a couple of episodes ago, but that they're covering it up without letting him know they're doing it or even that he's been caught. Jerry is also keeping Shiv off of Logan's calendar for the day because, after courting Rhea Jarrell, Frank's contact at Pierce, we see Kendall on the roof placing the last of what has apparently been many messages. Kendall has gotten Rhea to agree to come in for a very secret meeting, and yay, she's played by Holly Hunter. She lets them know the family's position right away.
We know you're interested in an acquisition again, and I have a message. clue.
Yeah. The message would be, on behalf of the Pierce family and the media organization it is privately owned for 150 years, the message would be a typically balanced, nuanced, and objective fuck off.
Very nuanced.
So she comes just for this lunch with Logan and Kendall alone. And it's so interesting to watch Logan in this scene because it's the first time we've seen him in a supplicant position. And he is so gentle and deferential to Rhea that he's almost unrecognizable. So we see that he can keep his rage in check. He just usually doesn't need to because he has no one to impress.
Yeah, I think scenes like this are important. You know, let me give you a random callback, Tara, which is, as you probably have started to figure out, is something I really enjoy doing. This reminds me of like season two. This reminds me of season two of The Office. Season two of The Office. Let me try to take you on this journey with me. That like, there was this moment in season two when Michael Scott, played by Steve Carell, had to present some like sales figures to his bosses, and like at first he like does some song and dance that's very weird, but then after that he does take out his sales numbers and gives them to his bosses. And I was listening to the commentary of The Office season two, and they're saying it's very important that we depict Michael as being somewhat competent, like that he's not just completely 100% incompetent all the time. But that was like theoretically part of his character. And this kind of feels like that to me as well, where Logan is shown being a very smart and savvy businessman and negotiator, at least comparatively speaking to how we've seen him before, which is paranoid and acting out and very shouty. He's a very shouty businessman. This kind of felt like that to me, like showing another side that we haven't seen of him before, right?
Well, that, and also in the last episode when he was getting that checkup, the doctor said something about his meds might make him paranoid. And I feel like this scene is also important to show us that the way he was acting in Hungary wasn't only because of the meds, because he can turn it off, as we see in this scene. He can act like a reasonable, polite person.
One other thing I want to point out about the sequence of events is there is that moment when Shiv says to Kendall, like, oh, are like you're doing the meds now? I thought it was so-and-so. And he says, she missed a dose, ... You know, like,
yeah.
And that's all you need to know about their help is, like, there can basically be no room for error with these people. You know, like, if you make one mistake, you're gone. And who knows, like, if she's lucky, that person got fired, you know, like, as opposed to something much more horrible happening to them. So, I did enjoy that nice little touch and what is unsaid versus what is said. Lot going on even just early on this episode. What happens next?
Well, that's not all. So what else is going on is that ATN has recently hired a commentator named Mark Ravenhead, who is apparently at least a fascist, which has caused protesters to assemble outside the building. It then comes out that he might be not only a fascist, but literally a Nazi who got married at the Eagle's Nest, Hitler's country villa. Shiv, in the meeting where this is being discussed, signals Tom with a throat-slashing motion to call for Ravenhead's firing, but Sid feels differently.
ATN under siege. That's our line.
Sid doesn't want to fire someone who is a big draw for the network. And although Ravenhead has already been on the air, Tom is tasked to vet him, and it is not great.
Okay, so this is embarrassing, but just for the record and just so we have it, you are not and have never been a member of the Nazi Party of the United States, have you?
Come on, Tom, are you serious?
Nope. Thank you. Sorry to have to even ask. And oh yes, the Hitler dog thing.
Okay, the dog thing's bullshit.
Great, I thought so.
Different spelling.
Okay, different spelling.
Yeah.
Okay, and this other one that came up, just to fend this off, have you ever read Mein Kampf?
Yeah, a couple times, I guess.
A couple times? Are there Easter eggs in there you didn't get the first time?
Look, I'm interested in that period of history, Tom, okay? I've skimmed it.
Skimmed, yeah. Thank you. And what specifically do you find interesting about that period of history?
The scale. The tragedy.
Hell yeah. Yeah, and which tragedies specifically?
Europe decimated. 7 million Germans, 20 million Russians, 5 million Poles.
Yeah, just Just checking the till here, Mark, and it seems you're short a few million.
So this scene is one of my favorite scenes in any TV show I've seen this year because, A, I mean, it's just hilarious and awkward that Tom is trying to, you know, it's like, hey, yeah, it's just a formality. You need to go through this. And then you realize, like, oh, maybe it's not so much of a formality. And so there's that, like, delightful awkwardness and pain in that. But also, like, this Ravenhead guy is very good-looking, very well-spoken, and in an era that we live in today where white nationalists are getting glowing coverage in major news publications. I mean, just a week or two ago, the New York Times published this article about Stephen Miller in which they called him a young firebrand. You know, Stephen Miller, young firebrand. And it's just like, this scene shows that they might be good looking, they might understand how to say the right words and blend in with upper society while still holding potentially abhorrent views. But white nationalists are among us, they're everywhere, and you might need to dive in five layers deep before you figure out that they're standing right in front of you. So that was kind of my take on this scene. What did you think, Tara?
Yeah, I thought it was very well written to show like how they avoid dog whistle phrases and how to get out of direct questioning. Like, it's easy to be able to say, no, I never was actually literally in the Nazi Party of America, but that doesn't mean that you're not sympathetic to those viewpoints. And yeah, when he's like, have you read Mein Kampf? Yeah, a couple of times. Whew. He's just shrugs like it's no big deal. Anyway, yeah, it was a very well-written scene. And Tom's befuddlement at this person in front of him, like not having any shame about his whole deal politically is very well acted.
Well, it's just the dog having the same name but different spelling.
Yeah.
Is an amazing moment because you sense the gulf between those two characters at that moment where he's like, yeah, it's clearly not a big deal because the spellings are different. And Tom's like, I actually think that might not be true that it's not a big deal because the spellings are different, right? To his credit, this is the smartest I've ever seen Tom act.
Yeah.
And that is not going to last for long throughout this episode, right?
No. So Ravenhead and or Tom are both then saved by a weird sound from out on the floor. Apparently, there is a shooter. A uniformed security guard, not one of Logan's top tier guys, says something about a safe room, and Tom physically shoves at least one woman out of his way to get there. Greg follows, as do the security guard and two other nameless employees. And Greg can tell right away that this is just a room. And at the same time, we see Logan's fixer ushering him into the real safe room where he's soon joined by Shiv.
So I wanted to ask you a question, Tara. Do you have a chance to see the movie Force Majeure by any chance?
I have not.
All right. So that is a great movie, and I'd strongly recommend it. It was on Netflix for a while. I'm not sure if it's still there. But the fundamental, like, inciting incident of Force Majeure, it happens very early in the movie, so I don't think it's a spoiler. I mean, it's kind of the premise of the movie. So Force Majeure is a 2014 movie directed by Ruben Östlund, and it's this family. Like, picture a wife and a husband, two kids. They are going on a skiing trip. They're eating out on a deck, and all of a sudden, an avalanche starts coming down the side of the mountain, right? And the husband just freaking flees. Like, GTFO, he is out of there before, like, the mom and the kids can even get up. Mm-hmm. And the avalanche comes, and it kind of envelops them, but, like, it's, like, it's very light, you know? Like, it covers everyone in snow, but, like, no one is hurt or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And the rest of the movie is spent dealing with the consequences of that action, right? Uh-huh. Of this action of, hey, you just kind of fled and left your wife and kids behind. Like, what was up with that? That's not super cool. Mm-hmm. And I was very much reminded of that scene and that movie during this scene with Tom shoving women out of the way to get to the safe room. Because I think that many people would like to imagine that in a very challenging situation, they would be selfless and be noble. But ultimately, many people would probably act like Tom, is where I'm going with this.
Yeah, it made me regret having accorded heroic qualities to him in the last episode for not diming out Greg about the biographer, because he's He does not look that heroic this week, for sure.
Yeah, this week is probably one of the low points in the Tom oeuvre, as it were. But anyway, so there is a live shooter situation. What else happens?
So for some reason, Greg then decides that trapped in a room with Tom is the right time to suggest that Greg explore opportunities at the company away from news, which, as he's already stated, he hates. Tom semi-jokes that it sounds like Greg is trying to break up with him, and Greg unwittingly makes a poor choice of words to minimize what he's asking.
It could be like a business open relationship.
Tom flies into a rage and starts pelting Greg with bottles of water while the other three adults in the room basically do nothing to intervene. The security guy kind of tries, but he does not get in between them.
We should just like pause briefly for a moment here that like, I think what we're seeing here, right, my sense, is Tom's psyche on the breaking point because of all the psychological and emotional abuse he suffered from Shiv. That's my my assessment of it, right? That he's like, he's had everything taken away from him, his dignity, theoretically the position that he was gunning for. And now the one thing that he thought he was almost certain he had control over, is theoretically heading for greener pastures. It was just too much for him. It's unfortunate.
Yeah, Greg couldn't have known that he was using triggering phrasing.
Indeed.
Okay, so Rhea had been departing when the active shooter situation sent the building into lockdown, so she also gets sent to the real panic room and is eventually joined by Kendall, who had gone back up on the roof again first, getting worryingly close to the edge. When everyone is gathered, we learn there was just one shooter, an ATN segment producer who shot himself at his desk. And because of Sid's ATN under siege framing at the meeting earlier, I for real thought until this moment that she faked the whole thing for sympathy or ratings or to distract from the Ravenhead situation.
Interesting. It did occur to me that the shooter might be some kind of ruse to force Rhea into the safe room with Logan to like get them into like a more advantageous bargaining position with Rhea. I don't think that's actually the case, but
it is very convenient timing.
It is extremely convenient that it would happen right at this critical moment in the history of ATN and their negotiations with Pierce. So, you can't really put anything by those ATN folks, I think is ultimately where we're at here. But you know who you also can't put anything past, Tara?
Hey.
Our Kickstarter backers, who are really awesome. And we need to take time to thank a few of them this week on the podcast. So I want to thank some backers: Jeannie Waker, Felidia, Uncle Good Advice, EJ Spangler, and Jason Lusky. Thanks so much for your contributions.
Thank you as well to Che from Austin. Hey, Che. Lauren Bearfield, Yazid Nafjan, John Barry, and Cliff Robinson. Thanks to all of you, and thanks, as we said earlier, to all of our backers, including the ones who we do not mention by name.
Yes, you are awesome, and you are why we are able to make this show.
So true.
All right, Tara, what else happens?
Well, so no one can leave the panic room quite yet, and a discussion of whether news should be a public utility or an entertainment option segues to Shiv reverse psychologizing Rhea into noting some of the reasons that a Roy takeover of Pierce might make sense, like consolidating legal and marketing departments, for example. Rhea parries, letting Logan and Kendall keep bidding against themselves, ending with this promise from Logan.
You know, we could drop some agreement with any number of provisions in it, but you know that if I want, I'll find a way around it. So, in the end, it's a question, right? If I say I won't fuck Pierce over, I'll keep the brand, their editors, their people. Do you trust me? And will you tell them to trust me?
Uh-huh.
Because when I say something will happen, that thing will happen. Am I right, kids?
Right.
Right.
So, will you tell them? 24. And they can trust me.
I feel like it's a truism that when someone says, trust me, you shouldn't. But I also feel like the previous three episodes of this season, at least, have been teaching the audience not to take Logan at his word ever.
I would completely agree with that. This scene I thought was interesting because it allowed Shiv to really show what she would do in a high-pressure situation that's very consequential for ATN. And your read of the situation was that she was reverse psychologizing Rhea, right? Like she was saying things in order to get Rhea to admit to the advantages of the deal. Is that
right?
As opposed to saying things not smartly on purpose, like by accident, right?
Right, because she starts out saying like, this deal doesn't make sense to me.
Right.
You know, there's a difference of culture and blah, blah, blah. And then that puts Rhea in the position of being like, well, actually, consider this. So,
yeah, she says like the business fundamentals aren't there or whatever. But like, in fact, like that's the one aspect that does make sense about the deal is that they can share, you know, different departments. But yeah, I don't know. Like I kind of have been wanting, you know, I'm rooting for Shiv this whole season. I've kind of been wanting to come in and just kind of like close the deal in some way or do something really spectacular. I don't feel that this scene lived up to that or impressed Logan. That was my take on it, at least. What did you think?
Well, we know that Shiv doesn't want this deal to happen, right?
It's true. Like in reality, she doesn't want it to happen. Yeah.
Yeah. She thinks it would be bad for the company, bad for America. It's like, it's not smart. So, you know, that's against my read of her being doing reverse psychology on Rhea. So if she's actually, instead of trying to maneuver herself into the best position with regard to Logan's favor, she's making the true case of what she thinks is actually best in a global sense, then she has better instincts and more care for the company and the country than anyone else in the room does, possibly.
Yeah, I guess I agree. It just feels a little bit muddled to me. It felt like, at best, a mixed victory for Shiv. And I kind of wanted it to be like more of an unequivocal victory or an unequivocal loss. I think it was just a little bit kind of in the middle somewhere. And so I am looking forward to see how the Shiv business acumen plays itself out in the context of the show, because I'm rooting for her. I'm rooting for her, but yeah, we'll see.
Well, as you know, my way of rooting for people is to hope for them to not have jobs at Waystar.
All right, fair enough.
So there's that. Okay, so while all of this is going on, we remember in the last episode, this guy named Mo, who had spoken to the biographer, he died. And so Connor and Willa are the only Roy representatives at Mo's funeral because of the lockdown. Thanks to a gaffe from a poorly briefed Willa, we learn this guy's name wasn't actually Mo. It was Lester, as in Mo Lester. And apparently he was. Connor says that he sort of waves it off at first, and then he's like, yeah, Dad wouldn't let us in the pool with them. So question mark of exactly what this guy's criminal activity potentially was. So after a conversation with the Wolf Pack, guys Mo and Logan used to wild out with in unspecified ways, Willa warns Connor not to speak at the funeral because they got up to some real rough illegal shit and it'll hurt Connor's campaign to be associated with him. Also in attendance is the aforementioned biographer, Michelle Pansel, trying to catch Connor in a slip. In the end, Willa edits down Connor's remarks for safety.
I'm here as a fellow human to acknowledge that Lester has, as we know, passed on. Lester was a man. Also, Lester was an employee of the Waystar Company for 40 years. And when a man dies, it is sad. All of us will die one day. In this case, it is Lester who has done so. Lester was alive for 78 years, but no more. Now he is dead. Lester's wife is Maria. They were married for 15 years. Now she is sad.
This was hilarious. This is the funniest part of the episode for
Agreed,
me. And
yeah.
I have a new respect for Willa with this content free eulogy because it tells me that she's smarter than I gave her credit for. Like she made this completely bulletproof. There's nothing in it that anyone could object to.
I absolutely love this sequence and I agree it's hilarious. It reminded me a lot of Jesse Armstrong's earlier work, specifically around Peep Show. I mean, this feels like this whole setup and all the dialogue could have come from a Peep Show episode, in my opinion.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yep.
Which is just like extremely awkward, like people looking out for themselves, like people trying to avoid an awkward scenario and thereby creating like something way more awkward and painful as a result.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think this is awesome. This is really hilarious. Very disconnected from everything else that's going on, but a lot of fun this episode. So
yeah. So Roman, also offsite, he's taken Jerry's advice and enrolled in the 6-week intensive management training course at Bright Star, the theme park. Although this time, his time there starts badly when his image appears in an introductory video, but he doesn't actually speak in the video, which he bitches to Jerry about. He gets paired up with a guy named Brian for their first assignment to create a park attraction. And although Roman tries to pass himself off as Ron Rockstone, it's not like he's in disguise, and Brian obviously recognizes him and knows who he is.
Yeah, my favorite part is when Brian says, like, solid name, dude. Solid name. Like he knows he's full of shit. That was awesome.
Yep. So Brian is about to present their pitch for a VR experience that lets park guests storm the beach at Normandy when a functionary comes in to tell Roman about the lockdown at Waystar and take him to someplace relatively safe. Afterward, Brian tells him that theirs was the winning pitch, although Roman doesn't trust him because he thinks he got it due to nepotism. Later, he calls Tabitha. When he hears she's about to get in the tub, he decides to try to have sex, try to have phone sex with her. But everything that she says is, according to him, too specific and grosses him out, and he ends the call. And then he calls Jerry, and we get a new data point on the question of what Roman's deal is sexually.
Go to bed, Roman. Go to bed and masturbate all your ideas out, and let's see how excited you feel tomorrow.
Well, maybe. Maybe I will. I mean, maybe I'll just leave you on the pillow so you can hear my brilliance cascading.
Fine. I've heard plenty worse than a spoiled brat ejaculating on himself.
Oh, yeah? You sure about that? I could be doing it now for all you know.
Well, get going. Chop, chop. You disgusting little pig. You're pathetic. You are a revolting little worm, aren't you?
Yeah. Yeah, I am.
Yes, you are, you nasty little piglet. You little slime puppy.
Yes. Yeah, what else am I?
You're revolting, Roman.
Yes. Yeah.
All right, Tara, what is going on here in your opinion?
Okay, so in our notes, I just have at this point 5 exclamation marks. I loved this too. We didn't even mention this in the last episode, but in the part in the hunting episode where Jerry is helping him get dressed.
Yeah.
He says something to her like, if I was capable of movement, I would pounce on you right now. And she like doesn't really take him seriously. She says, oh, you'd be surprised how often I hear that usually from guys in their 90s. But I love that that Roman, like, this is, he likes Jerry because you know what? Jerry's the shit. Like, Jerry's really sexy. She clearly knows how to, like, get his goat. She plays along. Like, what he wants is some kind of humiliation experience. And she's like, great, I'm here for it. And, like, just is so game for it. Like, again, the ultimate survivor, Jerry. Like, Jerry knows what to do in every situation.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was, I don't know if surprising is the right word, but like certainly I was taken aback at how quickly she kind of adjusted to that new reality.
Mm-hmm.
That she'd be, you know, helping this guy get off over the phone.
Yeah.
Isn't she like their godmother or something like that? That was another thing. I recall that from season one that she,
oh,
you know,
they've
known each other since like youth, basically.
Yeah, but that makes it all the more transgressive, you know, like,
yeah.
And I guarantee people are going to be clipping Jerry calling him a dirty little pig and making that their ringtone on their phone. So good.
Yeah. Yeah. So like, do we think that Roman can only be turned on by humiliation, or like that's one of his kinks, or, you know, or is it like just something about Jerry specifically? Like, that's kind of what I'm curious about.
Yeah. I feel like we don't have enough information to make that assessment right now, but it would certainly scan that for someone in his position that humiliation would turn him on.
Hmm. Well, I guess we will continue to learn more about the evolving, or, you know, our understanding of his sexuality will continue to evolve. But certainly, We have a lot more information today than we did last week. So
we sure do. So back to the office. Once they're freed from the moderately safe room, Greg tries again to get Tom's blessing for him to explore opportunities outside of news. When Tom balks, Greg tells him about the incriminating papers he copied in season one and essentially asks Tom if he can use those to blackmail him. Tom then promises to promote Greg and give him a huge raise because he's so impressed by and proud of the way Greg used this leverage against him. And I really thought Tom was going to counter by mentioning Greg's meeting with the biographer, but maybe he's already forgotten.
I do think it is worth pointing out that, like, anytime somebody in the family tries to blackmail another person, they are met by being, like, the person who they're trying to blackmail being impressed. I mean, that's happened multiple times throughout the course of this show, is that they speak a certain language. One aspect of that language is blackmail, and if you do it, they will respect you.
Yes.
I don't know if that's how it works in real life, but it definitely definitely seems to be part of the language of the show. So, and that happens here as well.
Yes. So on her way out, Rhea suggests that a nice peace offering to the Pierces would be to fire Ravenhead. So it's lucky that this meeting happened, because I feel like otherwise he wouldn't have gotten fired no matter what Tom found out in their meeting. But I do wonder, is it possible Ravenhead was vetted properly and the decision was taken either A, to roll the dice that ATN viewers are cool with Nazis, or B, hire him to fire him and thus win an actually tough on Nazis news cycle, with the possible side benefit of C, making their other newscasters seem less fascist by comparison? I'm just to give a real world example. If Fox News hires and then quickly fires Richard Spencer, Tucker Carlson doesn't look so bad the next day after that happens. You know what I mean?
I just feel like there's this whole idea of, like, you know, Trump is playing 3D chess, you know, and he's 18 moves ahead. And, like, certainly that narrative has cropped up a couple times. Like, oh, like, he's doing all this stuff on purpose. He's trying to distract you from the blah, blah, blah. And it's like, well, I don't know about, like, I think you're right, Tara, that in the universe of the show, it's very possible that Ravenhead was a deliberate move. Like, it might be revealed later on, oh, why do you think we brought Ravenhead in? Blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. You know, like, that might be revealed. But I think in real life, these kinds of decisions are often more dunderheaded than they might be in fiction. So
yeah, I mean, I'm sure it's very possible we will never know. I would just say I give Sid more credit for tactics than I do Trump.
Yeah,
but
I
also
think
that having Antifa downstairs protesting outside of ATN only serves to, like, please their core audience. Like, that doesn't make them look bad.
Mm, indeed.
Their viewers like that.
Just a couple more scenes in this episode, right, Tara?
Yes, we're almost done. So Kendall and Shiv end up alone together in Logan's office, where she asks him if Logan made him an offer in the Hamptons. Kendall says he didn't and seems to have figured out that Logan did make an offer to her. And Kendall asks Shiv to hug him, and she's alarmed to feel him crying against her shoulder, after which he says this.
I would just ask that you take care of me, because if Dad didn't need me right now, I don't exactly know what I would be for.
And so after this, you know, Shiv offers to talk to Kendall some more after he's just made this plea to her. And I feel like it's the first truly kind thing we've seen her do ever.
Yeah, like, she's generally not the most magnanimous character, right?
Yeah, she's really disturbed and surprised to see him acting this way.
Yeah, and this is also the first time we've seen in the second season, which we're almost, like, halfway through at this point, this is the first time we've seen Kendall acknowledge to another person how terrible his situation is, how existential it is, that he seems to understand, like, the moment his usefulness is done, he is out on his ass.
Yeah.
And he has never said that out loud to anyone. And this is the first time he's done that. And it is absolutely heartbreaking.
If his siblings and other people that don't know the whole story of what happened at the wedding have seen him acting like this, they would maybe recognize the shape of it, because we know from season one, he had already been an addict in recovery. So they would probably chalk a lot of this up to like, oh, well, he's using again. So that's why he's being like this. Mm. That's why he's such a sad sack. He's so ashamed, like blah, blah, you know, that it's all part of that spiral because they would have no reason to know it's something else. But for Shiv to actually acknowledge like, oh, something much worse is happening. And I don't think he's going to tell me what it is. Like, it's an upsetting scene. But it's good to know that she is human somewhere inside.
I found it to be deeply moving. And I thought, Jeremy Strong, in my opinion, who plays Kendall, is my MVP of the show. Mm-hmm. And he's really upping his game in this episode. So I loved it.
Yeah, because Kendall can't just be like sad sacking around all the time. Like that's part of it. But he also has to rise to the occasion. And Strong's performance, like you can tell what it costs him to try to be his old competent self while he's being crushed under this burden.
Yeah.
So he really is doing amazing work this season for sure.
Agreed.
So we only see a brief snippet of the following day as Kendall goes back up to the roof and sees that a clear, tall barrier has been erected. And it's weird to feel both reassured and chilled that unseen watchers are monitoring Kendall this closely, which is to say the barriers made me think that Kendall didn't even necessarily get caught shoplifting. It's that his tail, who we don't even know who it is, saw him do it.
Right. So, and just to be 100% clear, right, and make the subtext text, is that the idea is that he's been up on the roof and his dad or the people following him are worried he'll jump off.
Right.
And so now there's barriers there to prevent him from jumping off. We should say those scenes are gorgeous. At the top of the roof, and it's actually in general, there's a reason you don't see that many shows or movies shoot in tall buildings. It's because it's a huge pain in the ass to like get the equipment up there, and shoot in the open elements. Like it's, you know, there's a lot of variables, and so like the fact that they did it just for like these few brief scenes, you know, is very effective. And you do get the sense that he might be contemplating jumping, and then of course, even the fact that he's contemplating it, at the end when he's kind of like bumping his head up against the barrier, you realize how truly trapped he is. Like he can't even contemplate suicide as a possible escape from his current circumstances. So it's a beautiful like moment when his head is up against that barrier, and it's kind of like a metaphor and like the opposite of metaphor when it's actually real, you know.
Yes.
Yeah.
He's literally trapped.
Yeah.
He's like an animal in a zoo. He's in a panopticon. Someone is watching him. He doesn't know who, and he can't escape.
Literally, I think that's the word I was looking for. But you know, it's literal and a metaphor. But people have misused literally so much. It's really. it's gone out of my head as the correct word. So, yes. Okay. So that's the episode. Every week on The Sweet Smell of Succession, we give our assessment of winners and losers of the episode. A winning Roy, a losing Roy, a winning non-Roy, and a losing non-Roy. Tara Ariano, who is this week's winning Roy for you?
Logan Roy is my winning Roy. He, as far as we can tell, is playing the Pierce thing well after an initial hiccup thanks to Roman, and has made a firm offer and that it's being taken back and is going to be, from what it sounds like, taken seriously. And he said he was going to go after Pierce and he would win, and that seems to be bearing out from what we've seen so far.
So Logan is your winning Roy. We'll see how it plays out and whether his offer is good or whether it progresses. My winning Roy of the week is Greg. Because by threatening blackmail, he's able to get himself, presumably, a significant raise and a promotion in terms of his position, and show Tom that he is his own man, which Tom, I think, comes to begrudgingly accept. So that is why Greg is my winning Roy of the episode. Losing Roy. Tara, who's your losing Roy of the week?
Well, we don't need to belabor it because we pretty much just finished talking about it, but Kendall...
Yeah,
for all the reasons we just said.
Yeah, he's in a challenging situation, and he is really starting to feel it. So Kendall is also my losing Roy of the week. Winning non-Roy. What do you think, Tara?
Well, I'm going to go with Jerry. I already called her the ultimate survivor. And in progressing to this new place in her relationship with Roman last week, I don't think we clipped it, but there was a moment where Shiv referred to Tom as her meat puppet. And I think this moment with Jerry and Roman on the phone, it makes him into her meat puppet. So having another Roy that she can manipulate potentially is only going to be better for her.
Hmm. Interesting. Good choice for your winning non-Roy, Jerry. My winning non-Roy, I'm going to go on a limb and say Rhea, who is played by Holly Hunter. She entered the situation looking to, like, showing strength, right? Being like, hey, fuck off. Like, it doesn't matter what your offer is. We are not prepared to negotiate. And in doing so, is able to theoretically secure concessions that she wouldn't be able to otherwise. And she'll have a very good offer and story to take back to her bosses. Whether or not they even accept, I think she certainly acquits herself well in this episode. Plus, it's always nice to see Holly Hunter in a movie that's not directed by Zack Snyder. So, Rhea is my winning non-Roy of the week. Losing non-Roy, who do you think, Tara?
Well, we didn't even mention this part because it's so brief, but at an earlier point in the episode, Greg goes to Tom's office to talk to him about something or other. And when he opens the door, this other employee named Jonah is on his hands and knees with Tom's feet on his back because Jonah lost a bet and therefore Jonah has to be his footstool. This is the culture at News, apparently, because Jonah is just doing it. I mean, this is the same thing we were talking about last week, where it's like, you can just leave. You don't have to knuckle under to this. But apparently that's how it is at News. Might be one of the reasons Greg hates it. So Jonah the footstool is my losing non-Roy of the week.
And we should point out that, like, from stories we've heard about working at Fox News, that some people do in fact find it quite humiliating. Like from what I remember reading, you know, remember that guy, there was this one guy that like wrote stories from within Fox News and then he got outed and then like had to like, do you remember what, you know what I'm talking about? Like there's that
no.
guy. That, okay. Well, there's this guy that basically worked at Fox News and then like he started leaking from within Fox, but then he got discovered and then had to like deal with the consequences of that. But he described it as to be like a kind of a very hellish working environment. And I don't know if there's something more hellish about Fox than other outlets like MSNBC, but certainly we have seen that. I think what I would argue is that a company's culture starts at the top and goes all the way down. And if your CEO or founder and or chairman and or president is really into ritualistic humiliation, then many of the underlings are likely to pick that up as well.
I feel like I need to go back and check this because now it occurs to me that maybe Jonah is the segment producer that killed himself because we find out that he left a note talking about a culture of bullying. It could just be that it's that pervasive, but it could be that Tom using him as a footstool was like the last straw.
Yeah. I don't know that it's ever made clear who it is, though.
I don't think they said his name either.
Yeah. Maybe we'll find out next week.
Maybe.
And maybe there'll be more consequences for Tom. But losing non-Roy for you, Jonah the footstool, I have to agree. Definitely the person who got most humiliated this episode. So those are our thoughts on winners and losers, plus overall thoughts on season 2, episode 4. Tara, were you a fan of this episode? What'd you think?
I keep saying the same thing. It's very well done. I like that we're starting to see more people from Pierce. I think that's an exciting area for the show to explore. And I know some other guest stars that are coming that are exciting. So I was happy to see Holly Hunter and see where this story skein goes. But, you know, it's rough that guy had to shoot himself for all this drama to happen.
Yep. Agreed. I feel the same way. And also, I just kind of want the Shiv storyline to get some more momentum one way or the other. And I feel like this episode kind of started doing that, but I want her to either demonstrate how competent and appropriate she is for this job or start really demonstrating how not appropriate and how terrible of a fit this is. Because I feel like this is kind of like an in-between area. I don't know.
Maybe the point of that final scene is for this episode is for her to realize he needs it more than she does.
he needs, Kendall needs
to be the successor more than she does, and that she would somehow like figure out a way to step aside or position him better. Mm. But that would be extremely selfless. We have not seen evidence that she has that capacity, but it would be a lot of character development if she did.
I took it more like, that he suspected and understood that she is very well positioned to take over, and he knows he's not going to be the one, and he wants like Shiv to take care of him, right?
Mm-hmm.
When Kendall becomes on the outs and shunned by society, like he wants Shiv to take care of him. That's kind of what I was assuming he meant when he's like, "Can you please like take care of me somehow?" Because he knows he's going to end up on a bad situation. And I think you're saying like, "Oh, maybe she's going to interpret that to mean like she can position him well." I don't know. We'll see. I agree that she has not been the most generous person. So. I thought it was a well done episode. I agree with you that the Pierce stuff is very promising, and we'll see how that plays out. So,
yep,
that's season 2, episode 4 of Succession. And that's going to bring us to the end of this week's episode. This episode was produced and edited by Tara Ariano and David Chen, and it was powered by Simplecast, the first and last word in podcast management and distribution. If you're looking to start your own podcast, check out simplecast.com. They are a great solution. Find more episodes at successionpodcast.com. Email us at successionpodcast@gmail.com. You can also reach us online in different places. Tara, where can people find more of your work?
They can find links to whatever I'm working on at Tara Ariano on Twitter, TaraAriano. And you can hear me every week on the Extra Hot Great podcast every Wednesday morning.
Find me on Twitter at Dave Chensky. That's Dave Chen, SKY. And also, I host an interview show called Culturally Relevant. You can find that on Apple Podcasts or culturallyrelevantshow.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.